This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, what does a French horn sound like when you play it like a guitar? The director of UW-Madison's Electroacoustic Research Space joins the show to share some of the new sounds he's coming up with. I'm excited about that, and I'm excited about this. When Katmai National Park and Preserves more than 2,000 brown bears wake up from hibernation in the spring, they got to gain hundreds of pounds by fall hibernation season. Brown bears in the park in Alaska travel for food to lakes, harbors, lagoons, and to Brooks River Falls, where the National Park Service sets up live webcams for bear biologists and rangers to monitor those bears in their natural habitat, and for the public to watch the bears in real time. As regular listeners may know, I am a big fan. You can find a link to the webcam at WPR.org/Central Time. Leon Law is the visual information specialist for Katmai National Park and Preserve. Leon, thanks so much for joining us today.
It is always a pleasure to talk about bears.
I love these webcams because whenever I look, there's bears there. What is it that makes Brooks Falls such a sweet spot to see these brown bears in action?
Yeah, so when you think about Brooks Falls, it is unique because we often see high concentrations of bears fishing here, especially during July. And I've been on the platform near the falls myself, and this season seeing 40 plus bears all in one view. And really, it's because of the dynamics of the salmon run, but also the landscape itself. So the Brooks Falls waterfall itself is only 6 feet high, but it spans the entire river, and it creates a temporary obstacle for salmon migrating upstream. So there are high concentrations of fish, which in turn bring high concentrations of bears to the area.
Now, I am a fan from the public, and there are often as many as 2,000 people watching at a time. It's also important, I understand, to bear biologists. What kind of things are they learning by watching these webcams all the time?
We can learn so much about bear behavior and just being able to witness things both during the day and at night and be able to play back moments too. So we can see some incredible natural moments. We learn about bears' fishing styles and habits and preferences as well.
Yeah, I've been watching, and a lot of the fans do too, the different ways these brown bears have to catch salmon. Can you let us know a few of the different techniques we see in action?
Sure. You can see quite a few different fishing strategies. And for instance, there are some bears that'll fish at the top of the waterfall at a place we call the lip. And they essentially wait for salmon trying to jump the waterfall as they move upstream and then catch them as the fish make their way up. And it's a technique that not all bears are able to master. So it really does show skill. And other fishing techniques that we see include snorkeling, diving, a dash and grab technique, which is very active and fun to watch, pirating, and more.
Being able to watch these bears, not just day after day, but literally year after year, we start to see that these brown bears are different from one another, different personalities, as you said, different fishing techniques and schools. How important is it to be able to track not just the bears as a whole, but these individual bears?
It really lets us know them as individuals, and we get to see that, and it helps us identify them as well. We don't use collars or anything, so we really ID bears by their physical characteristics, but also more so even perhaps by their habits and their preferences. And getting to watch them as individuals really shows us the range of behavior.
Now, we have black bears here in Wisconsin. You've got brown bears there at Katmai. Can you talk about the weight gain that these guys need to do, mostly or in large part by eating salmon, but they really need to go from skinny to fat in not that much time?
Absolutely. From the beginning of the season to the end of their waking season, essentially, they need to eat an entire year's worth of food in 6 months or less. So gaining fat is really important. During hibernation, they're not going to eat or drink anything, but rely solely off of those fat reserves. And so that's why it's super important for them to put on so much weight. And within a season, we might see bears gain several hundred pounds. And some of our largest bears are weighing 1,400 or so.
Now, you mentioned being on the platform, I think where the camera is, being that close to bears. Sometimes on the screen, I could see people downstream fishing a little bit. I feel like these bears are really big, and I'd be kind of nervous because do I just look like a big salmon to them? What's it like being that close to them in person?
Yeah, I would say every day brings something new to witness and experience. And being that close to them is really pretty incredible to know that we are just visitors in their home. And being able to have this experience and watch them live out their wild and natural lives.
Now, the bears get numbered and sometimes a name gets attached to them. I know a fan favorite is Otis 480, who's about 20 years old or so now. Are there particular individual bears that you've personally latched onto?
As individuals, you get to see some of these tiny moments. And there are so many bears that I love. I love them all. But getting to see some of those really intimate moments is really pretty fascinating to watch. And so for me, there are definitely different bears that call to me. 151 Walker is one, but then also especially the sows with cubs and watching them grow and learn together is really interesting.
Now, my entry point, Leon, into the bears there was the annual Fat Bear competition. That's what attracted my attention and led me to find the webcams. Let us know what the Fat Bear contest is all about.
Ah, yes, Fat Bear Week. It is also one of my favorite times of year. And essentially, what we do is we take the four photos from early summer and then show them in the later summer when they've gained the weight. And we essentially match bears up against each other in a March Madness style bracket. And then viewers get to choose who ultimately gets crowned the Fat Bear Week champion.
Leon, thank you so much for sharing this. A big fan watching from here in Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me.
That's Leon Law, visual information specialist for Katmai National Park and Preserve in Alaska. She joined us to talk about the live bear cams at Katmai's Brooks River Falls. If you want to take a look yourself, you might get hooked. We've got a link to the bear cam on our website at wpr.org/centraltime. You will see salmon being eaten, so maybe not while you're eating. I don't know. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about backyard baseball.
Remember the classic scene in The Sandlot when Smalls hits a homer into the neighbor's yard? And it turns out the baseball he swiped to do this was signed by Babe Ruth.
Babe Ruth! The Great Bambino!
Well, writer Chris Hardy had his own moment like this back on the farm he grew up on in western Wisconsin.
Midsummer. Circa 1973. My brother Kevin and I were playing baseball. Our makeshift diamond had the chicken coop as the backstop, sand and gravel as our infield, a very spacious center field, and no pulling allowed. Our limited supply of baseballs made us search long and hard for balls that disappeared into the weeds. Mom had recently found a great deal on baseballs that were 3 for $1, but the balls turned into mush after a couple of whacks and were pretty much unusable. So we decided to borrow the baseball. Dad was not a collector, but he did have one treasured possession, a baseball that he caught at a 1957 Milwaukee Braves game. 57 was a magical year for Milwaukee baseball. Hank Aaron won the Most Valuable Player Award. Warren Spahn won the Cy Young. Milwaukee won the National League pennant and defeated the New York Yankees in the World Series. Our intent was to return the baseball after we were done playing. Since it wasn't autographed or anything, it would be no harm, no foul. Kevin's Louisville slugger rested on his shoulder as I leaned in from the mound, a board on a slight rise of sand. The baseball felt good in my hand. The special ball called for a special pitch. "Here comes my knuckle curve, Kev," I proclaimed and let it fly. MLB.com says the knuckle curve is one of baseball's greatest paradoxes. It's a pitch very few have mastered and only used when hitters will be fooled by it. I had certainly not mastered the pitch, and announcing in advance was not very deceptive. It really didn't spin or flutter, but just sort of hung in the air. With a flick of the bat, Kevin sent the horsehide-wrapped, cushion-corked ball with its 108 double stitches soaring into the summer sky. We watched in awe as the ball rose higher and higher into center field and went up and over the barn. We stood for a moment, stunned. A good shot was when you hit the side of the barn. Sometimes you can even reach the roof. Never was a ball hit over the barn until now. Baseball history had just been made. "Holy crap, Kev," I said. "I think you got all of that one." "I think so," he said. Our relation was immediately tempered. That was Dad's ball. We ran into the no man's land behind the barn, a massive thicket of head-high weeds intertwined with old farm equipment. We searched for about an hour before giving up. How were we to break the news to Dad that his precious sports souvenir was gone? We decided to deflect some of the fault to another party who had no knowledge of the crime, but in our minds was really the person to blame. After chores that evening, while we were eating dinner, we told Dad what happened. "You did what?" his booming voice raised rhetorically. "But it was Mom's fault," Kevin said. "If she wouldn't have bought those cheap baseballs, we wouldn't have had to use yours." It wasn't fair to gang up on Mom, but it was the diversion that we needed. Dad went from near eruption status to steaming, and we promised to look for the ball again the next day. We never found the baseball. Dad forgave us. The next week, Mom stopped at the local Coast to Coast and bought us some new, real baseballs. We played baseball lots that summer. I never did master the knuckle curve, but I'll always remember the shot heard round the farm.
Chris Hardy is a writer who lives in Taylor. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a UW-Madison music professor joins the show to tell us about electroacoustic music and how he and his students experiment with instruments and sound. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. What does a French horn sound like in your head? Maybe something like this. All right, but what if you changed how it sounds, say, with a distortion pedal like the cool rock guitar guys do? Pretty cool. That last sound is from a collection of recordings called Air Names. It was made by our next guest with the help of the Electroacoustic Research Space at UW-Madison's School of Music, also called EARS. It's a studio that lets musicians experiment with acoustic instruments, say a French horn or a flute, and electronic instruments like synthesizers and processors to come up with really different kinds of sounds and music. Dan Grabois, an assistant professor of horn and the director of UW-Madison's Electroacoustic Research Space. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Paint us, please, a picture of this lab.
This lab is a former classroom that has been repurposed. So it's in the humanities building, but it doesn't have the aura of the humanities building. It's updated a little bit, and it is chock full of electronic instruments.
What was the inspiration for you to have not just these electronic instruments, but this interface between traditional acoustic instruments and all this electronic gear?
Well, for me, that started when I got to UW. I had before been the chair of contemporary performance at the Manhattan School of Music, and I hired a colleague to come and teach electronic music to my students, and they were making incredible sounds, and I thought, wow, I could change the sound of the horn and play a much bigger variety of music. So when I got here, I was provided with some research funds, and I started buying pedals and microphones and that sort of thing. And I made the Air Names recording that you just played a little bit of, which was mostly featuring the horn in various kinds of distortion and with effects on it. From there, everything derived out of an email that I received one summer, and it said, "We are offering a round of UW 2020 large equipment grants." And the idea behind this grant was really, hey, chemistry department needs an electron microscope, and so does biochemistry. So let's provide one electron microscope and have them share. And I thought, well, I could put together a ton of pieces of electronic music equipment and call that large equipment. And so I put in an application. I got everything I asked for. So thank you, Worf.
Now let's check out another clip, another taste of the music. This is from your latest project, released coming out in October, I think, called Fire Names. I think I'm hearing a fairly unprocessed French horn out front there. What's going on behind it, though?
So this really is electroacoustic music. The French horn's completely unprocessed, except that it's being recorded, obviously, mm-hmm. so there's some amount of mixing going on. But yes, so what I did is I wrote a tape track. Of course, there's no tape involved anymore. Everything is digitally recorded. But I used the instruments in ears to create this 44-minute-long tape track, and then I wrote a horn part to go on top of it. And so when I was recording the horn part, which I did in my basement with ears microphones, I didn't have to distort the horn at all. I wanted it to be very pure, and I played over that tape track.
Now, I'm kind of a music nerd. As I looked at the list of your electronic equipment, it includes things like old Moog synthesizers, a theremin, I think, and then some things I've never heard of, including a Continuum fingerboard.
Yeah, that's actually if I had to choose a favorite child, it would be the Continuum fingerboard. It's an instrument that's been in production for something like 15 or 20 years, but it changes every few years and is updated. It was invented by someone named Lippold Hocken, who teaches engineering at the University of Illinois. And the reason it's called a continuum is it has a keyboard, but the keyboard is made of squishy foam with the notes more painted on the foam than actual separate notes. So you can drag your finger along the keyboard and make it go continuously, hence continuum fingerboard. And it's a very expressive instrument.
So that makes me think like a fretless bass, where usually you'd have distinct notes there, but without the frets, you can move up and down. Same thing. I never would have thought it possible for a keyboard.
Yeah, it's an incredible invention. And it responds also in several other directions. So that side to side or X axis is operating with the instrument, but there's also a Y axis. So the keyboard has a certain thickness, and it's a synthesizer. So for some of the sounds, as you move your finger further away from you or more towards you, the sound will transform. And then the Z axis, how hard you push down, generally controls how loud or soft you play, but it can be programmed to control anything you want.
Talking to Dan Graboy from UW-Madison, director of the Electroacoustic Research Space. We're checking out some of their music, and I want to give a listen to, I think you're featuring your favorite kid, as you said, the Continuum fingerboard, in this excerpt from Fire Names. Here's a listen. I think I'm hearing what is the Continuum fingerboard with those where you can.
Yeah.
Yep.
That bass line is Continuum fingerboard, but the thing that goes da-dee-da-dee is also Continuum fingerboard
really?
With a different sound. This is all recorded multi-tracked, so you record one thing and then you put something else on top and you have infinite tracks that you can use.
Okay, one more taste of that, I think. A later part here in Fire Names. Tell us a little more about what we're hearing there.
Right. So everything you heard there is Continuum, and it's a big, big, juicy, fat sound on the bottom. And then on top, this sort of Asian-sounding instrument, which is really interesting. It uses that Z-axis, how hard you push against it. The harder you push against it, the more it goes boing and bends up. So if you just tap it, it goes ding, 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 ding. And as you push harder, boing, boing, boing. So it makes a really kind of an interesting ornamented sound.
Okay, so this is in effect a music laboratory. What kind of things do music students get in and experiment, slash play with in there?
So I have a band that's a student ensemble. It's actually a class. And the band is called $2 Broom. And if anybody gets the reference, they win the prize for the day. But we improvise using the instruments. So students learn how to play the instruments, which is usually pretty easy. Most of the instruments have a very tactile interface. And in fact, for, say, a cellist or a violinist that has become very, very engrossed in their technique on their instrument, putting their hands in front of the theremin and moving them around and see what happens is a really revelatory experience. It's no longer about just how you make that vibrato with your left hand and how you draw the bow, but just pure experimentation. So we go on stage with this band at the end of each semester and play for about an hour with nothing written down and nothing planned.
Okay, but suppose somebody comes in there with a cello or a French horn or whatever. They've devoted their life to this instrument in a lot of ways, and they're playing through some of these processors and synthesizers and things like that. What is their reaction? Is it, this is cool, or wait, this isn't what my instrument is supposed to sound like?
Usually their reaction is something that I can't even quote on the radio.
They're generally, in a good way or a bad way?
In a good way.
Okay.
They're usually so excited about what their instrument will sound like, and we do that. For instance, we had a cellist play on our last concert, and he did some cello playing as well as playing other of the ears instruments, and he was running through effects. And what's so interesting is that you find that your playing changes based on what you're hearing, which is not that surprising, but it really draws that idea into focus, especially as you think of each musician as kind of a composer when you're improvising. So the ideas that are generated are inspired by the sound that's coming into your ears.
Briefly, as we wrap up, live gigs for $2 Broom or any other projects coming out where we could see this in action?
Yes, but you'll have to stay tuned because we set our concerts kind of in the middle of the semester. We figure out a time when everyone's free and when we'll be ready, but they may be billed as the Electroacoustic Improv Ensemble or $2 Broom. I'm not sure how our
like any band. What's the real name?
Yeah. The real name, as far as I'm concerned, is $2 Broom.
Dan, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Dan Graboi, assistant professor of horn and director of the Electroacoustic Research Space at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about his work at EARS and to share some of the experimental music he's made there. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Titanic might be the most famous shipwreck of all time, but it's not alone. The author of the new book, Sinkable, takes us on a tour of the millions of shipwrecks around the world and efforts to find and salvage them. Plus, a look at the latest research on the impact of COVID on kids and the possible long-term effects. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at Republican plans to replace potentially tens of thousands of career federal employees with loyalists in the event of a future Republican administration. First, we're taking a look at the Wisconsin state primary results. In the Republican race for governor, Tim Michaels won over Rebecca Clayfish. He was endorsed by former President Trump. She was endorsed by former Vice President Pence. On the Democratic Senate side, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes won as predicted, and incumbent Senator Ron Johnson makes their midterm matchup official. And Assembly Speaker Robin Voss kept his seat by a narrow margin. We're looking at the state primary results, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you vote in the primaries yesterday? Do you normally vote in these? If so, did your candidate win or lose? How do you feel about that? What are you watching for come November? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
All right, let's start with the Republican primary for governor, that most hotly contested statewide race, I think. Construction executive Tim Michaels winning 47% of the vote. Former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish, 42%. Dig into the results some for us, Sean.
I mean, it was a comfortable victory for Tim Michaels, I think you'd say. 5% does not sound big, but in the world of Wisconsin politics, and especially the way that this race seemed like it was shaping up, it's a pretty solid win for Michaels. What really stood out to me is I think everybody expected Rebecca Clayfish to do well in the suburban Milwaukee County. So especially Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington counties, the WOW counties. Those are the base, or were the base of Scott Walker's support as governor. They were expected to be the base of Rebecca Clayfish's support in her race for governor, her primary for governor. And she won two of those counties, but the fact that she didn't win all three and that Michaels actually carried Washington County is a sign that he kind of cut through some of the traditional boundaries that have divided recent primaries here. I mean, in recent Republican primaries, you've kind of had the Southeast Wisconsin candidate and then the candidate that wins in counties with smaller populations. In this case, Michaels won most of those counties, and then he also won Washington, a Republican powerhouse. So a big win for him for sure, but he's going to face a very different electorate in November.
Let's give a listen to Tim Michaels speaking last night after his win, talking about one of the reasons he may have won yesterday.
I'd like to thank President Trump for his support, for his endorsement. It was a tremendous validation of our meteoric rise in this campaign. He knows that we need to have new leadership in Madison, and he sees a lot of similarities. He didn't have to run for president. I don't have to run for governor. He wanted to drain the swamp. We found out it's a really big swamp, and I know that Madison needs firm executive leadership, and that's what I'm going to do as governor.
Can you talk about the role of that Trump endorsement, Sean?
I mean, I think it was critical. Tim Michaels got into this race in late April, and he did spend $12 million of his own money to get the word out about his campaign, which not everybody can do, obviously. And that, of course, was a factor in his race. And, you know, this may very well be a very good year for a candidate to make that outsider pitch, even if it doesn't exactly fit Michaels, somebody who's been involved with Republican politics for decades and who ran for U.S. Senate in 2004. All that said, though, after the Trump endorsement, you really saw his campaign shoot up in the polls, and you saw Rebecca Clayfish's campaign, who had been presumed the front runner for, you know, since she got into the race, you saw her campaign start to act differently, start to attack Michaels, which is something campaigns do when they're threatened or down. And so, you know, that Trump came to campaign for Michaels as it looked like the race was getting close in the closing days. He came to Wisconsin, and he drives Republican votes. He drives a Republican base vote in a big way, and in a base election, Tim Michaels was able to win.
In many cases, the price of admission to get an endorsement from former President Trump has been to agree with his claims of election fraud and follow his goal of somehow overturning results of the 2020 election. There was a Republican candidate who did that. His name was Tim Ramthan. He came in a distant third. What has Michael said about that older election, about future elections, about this election issue in general?
Yeah, I mean, you called it the price of admission, and I think that's the best way to put it. If you want to be a Republican who gets Donald Trump's support, you can't go out there and just overtly say the 2020 election was conducted legally and President Joe Biden definitely won. Tim Ramthan is on the other end of that spectrum and said that we need to overturn the results, but Trump didn't endorse him. We don't know why. You can speculate because Trump, you know, cares quite a bit about his win-loss record in these primaries as he prepares to run for president in 2024. Tim Michaels didn't quite go as far as Tim Ramthan, but he has questioned the 2020 election and won't just outwardly say, yes, President Biden won. And he also won't promise to certify the 2024 presidential election should he become governor, which is a duty of the governor. I mean, that's a ceremonial duty of the governor that we would normally take for granted, but not anymore. And Michaels just won't say that he'll do it. So that's how he kind of dealt with that issue. He may try to, you know, pivot away from that now that it's a general election. We don't know yet because he didn't outright say, yeah, the election was stolen. But he is definitely on the record questioning the election and saying he's open to the idea of decertifying the 2020 election, something that election law experts say is impossible.
Talking to WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about yesterday's primary election results. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Tim Michels' win in the Republican primary for governor? What issues do you want to hear about in the race for governor between incumbent Tony Evers, the Democrat, and now Tim Michels, the challenger, a Republican? How about the race for Senate? Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes against incumbent Senator Ron Johnson. How about this stuff going on with Robin Voss, currently Assembly Speaker, winning a close race to keep his seat in the Assembly in a primary? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sean, if I told you 2 weeks ago Robin Voss is going to face a really tight race for re-election to the Assembly, you would have said, I think, Rob, that's even more wrong than you usually are.
I mean, when the initial results for that Voss race started to come out last night, the first batch of votes came out, and Voss was narrowly down to Adam Steen, his Republican challenger. It was sort of like a jaw-dropping moment, and it, I think, you know, it hit me. I think it hit a lot of people that, wow, this thing is really close. And you started to think about the possibility that Robin Voss, who has run the Assembly for a decade and really sets the agenda for Republicans, especially without a Republican governor, that he could lose his Assembly race to, you know, a virtual unknown. It's just, I think there's just a long list of reasons why this was one of the, I guess, craziest primaries that I can remember covering. And the fact that, like, Voss was extremely vulnerable there at the end, probably in large part to that, due in large part to that Donald Trump endorsement of Steen the week before people voted, is kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, the quick story here. Voss hires former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman to investigate the election outcome, rejects attempts to, again, claim this impossible power to overturn the outcome of that election. Trump turns against him. Gableman turns against him, records ads for the challenger. Cool. Here is Voss talking yesterday about holding off that primary challenge about Michael Gableman.
Mike Gableman is an embarrassment to the state. So I am going to take some time to talk with my caucus next week. We actually have a caucus on Tuesday. I'm going to talk about it with all the members and see what the next step should be. But I am not going to let my joy for tonight be focused on a person like Mike Gableman who isn't worth the time to talk about.
We don't talk about Bruno. We don't talk about Gableman, but there he was talking about him, Sean.
Yes. I mean, and we didn't know also, like last week, we didn't know if Gableman was going to formally weigh in on this race. Trump had issued a statement when he announced that he was going to hold this rally in Wisconsin and said, oh, Mike Gableman supports Adam Steen, too, when Trump endorsed Steen, that is. We just hadn't heard it from Gableman. And even at the rally, Gableman is there. He says the prayer for Trump. Trump makes repeated references to Mike Gableman during this thing. But Gableman won't say where he's at on this Voss race. Well, not only was he endorsing Adam Steen, he is cutting a robocall saying, fire the guy who hired me to do this investigation, and says that anything that Gableman uncovered in his investigation, which did not show widespread fraud, was not because of Robin Voss, but in spite of him. I mean, Mike Gableman is still on contract with the state, which Robin Voss has, under the power of that agreement, has the power to terminate. So we'll see if it's going to happen. I mean, Robin Voss seems to be hinting pretty strongly that he wants to do that. But the way power works when you're speaker, you got to make sure that your members are on board with such a decision like that. So he's saying he's going to talk to them first.
We're talking to WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about yesterday's primary elections and their aftermath and what comes next. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the upcoming midterm elections after the results of the primaries? Do you think Michels has a good chance against incumbent Tony Evers? How do you think Mandela Barnes stacks up against incumbent Senator Ron Johnson? What issues do you want to hear about? Do you want the 2020 election to be at the center of the 2022 election? Do you want the Gableman probe to go on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about yesterday's primary elections with WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Big political news in the state. Quiet on the phones, though. Is this something you're not tracking yet, not worried about it until November? Or are you amped up about one or the other of these big statewide races for U.S. Senate, for governor, for some of the local elections as well? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Sean, you know, we're excited about this. Primary voters are excited. But what was the turnout like? How did it compare to your standard general election?
Oh, man. I got to admit, Rob, I have been doing stories since last night, and I don't know the turnout numbers as well as I should. So I do apologize for that.
Oh, that's okay. We'll check them out. Generally, though, these primaries don't see the turnout that we see in general elections. So it's kind of hard in general, I think, to read from them, from what happened yesterday, to what's going to be turnout like for the Democrats and Republicans come November.
Yeah, I'm absolutely. I mean, you're talking about in a primary, like a very different representation of Wisconsin than you're going to get in a general election. You're going to, and it's not just that you have, you know, in the Republican primary, obviously you have Republican voters, right? But you have more dedicated Republican voters. You don't have casual Republican voters, or maybe even a handful of independents in Wisconsin who would vote for either party in any given election. You know, once those people get brought into the fold, the numbers are going to go up. And so you're going to hear these candidates make or try to make pitches to this broader audience as they shift from the primary to the general. And, you know, the trick, it's not exactly easy doing that when you've had a very contentious Republican primary the way Michael's had with Clayfish, and where you're kind of dug in on some stuff.
I want to peek in at one more race. Now, the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin, key to control of that body. One congressional seat at play in Western Wisconsin, the 3rd District. Briefly set that up for us, Sean.
Yeah, the 3rd District is one of really the only districts in Wisconsin that is still considered competitive. This is a district that was held for many years by Ron Kind, held the seat for 13 terms, announced last year that he would not be seeking re-election, and Kind is somebody who's kind of defied the political odds in some years. I mean, even as his district has shifted toward Republicans and really specifically toward Donald Trump, Kind has prevailed. And, you know, he is a Democrat who is normally with the Democratic Party on most things, but is also the kind of Democrat who will vote against his party on some issues, and, you know, maybe bothers some national party leaders, but wins him his seat. You know, it's earned him a pretty good rep within the district. So that's the kind of a Democrat who's been able to win there. And so these Democrats who are vying to replace him are trying to fill those shoes. And the person who's going to be on the ballot is Brad Paff. And Brad Paff was endorsed by Kind. He beat, he had 39% of the vote. Rebecca Cook had 31%, Deb McGrath, 19%, Mark Newman, about 11%. So Paff will face off against Derek Van Orden, who lost narrowly to Kind in the last election. But, you know, I think it's going to be a tough one for Democrats, given the kind of political headwinds they're facing and the way that district has been shifting. But that is going to be one of the competitive congressional races that we have here in Wisconsin, especially since it's open.
Let's go to our callers. Louise is with us in Dodgeville. Louise, hello.
Hi, I have a question for your guest. What is your opinion about now that Michaels is the Republican candidate? Are moderate Republicans going to vote for Tony Evers instead? So, and I can take my answer off the air.
Louise, thanks for the call. Sean, we don't have a ton of crossover voting in the state. Is there polling on something like that?
Yeah, I don't know. There's going to be a Marquette poll coming out here soon. And not that they're the only pollster in town, but they have polled Wisconsin a lot. And they're going to be releasing something here, their first since the primary. And so we'll get a better idea of where people land on a straight Michaels versus Evers matchup. I don't think you'd expect a lot of moderate Republicans to go over to Evers just because of how polarized the state is. I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but I'm not sure that that's part of the Evers reelection plan. Although Evers does definitely try to reach out to that sort of, you know, mystical independent voter out there. I mean, we know they exist. And he talks about signing a Republican budget. You know, part of his message is that he has done stuff that Republicans like. I don't think you would look at the way that state government has operated in the last few years and say that, like, he has a great relationship with the Republicans who run the place. But he definitely has a record where he can point to and say, hey, you know, forget about how it happened. I signed this tax cut. I signed this Republican budget. And whether he's reaching out to moderate Republicans or independents, whatever, it's part of the Evers brand.
Louise, thanks for the call. Nate joins us next in Appleton. Nate, hello.
Hi. My question was, what is this continuing this investigation? What is it even going to accomplish anymore? And is this what every election is going to look like from here on out, where it's investigated for 2-3 years after the fact? I can take the answer off air. Thanks.
Nate, thanks for the call. Sean, is multi-year postmortems for elections potentially going to become a new normal?
Man, I hope not. I mean, I think part of the reason we have this investigation is because the leader of the Republican Party has not let the election go. And he still holds, obviously, look at Tim Michaels' victory. He still holds considerable sway with Republicans. And that, I would say, is why we have an investigation right now. I don't know if the election is going to, if the investigation, excuse me, is going to continue. It's not really continuing now. Former Justice Gableman is on the state payroll. His office still exists, but Voss has basically said it's there to, for the time being anyway, fight these lawsuits that challenge the legislature's subpoena authority to conduct the investigation. So there are still these lawsuits that are playing out. There's also open records lawsuits that, Speaker Voss and Mike Gableman have lost at circuit court level. Those are playing out. And so the contract with Gableman has basically been to fight those, to continue those. And once the subpoena power stuff is worked out, who knows? But as of this moment, there's not really an investigation going on. I don't know like how they fight the lawsuits if they were to fire Gableman, for example. If there's an office of special counsel and the special counsel disappears, what happens?
And just our last half a minute or so, Sean, I'm guessing we're going to see a lot of money flooding into Wisconsin with our high-profile races for governor and U.S. Senate.
Yeah, I was kind of amazed to know that there's really, at least according to Cook Political Report, there's 4 governor's races in the entire country that they consider toss-ups this year, and Wisconsin's one of them. And donors know the power of governorships. They know the power of a governor in Wisconsin. So money is definitely going to flow here. And then you have Ron Johnson, a Republican U.S. senator who, because of his kind of outspoken ways in the past few years, is very popular with his base, but not as popular with independent voters. I mean, his approval rating is not great. And he is seen as vulnerable. So he's going to have his supporters certainly throwing lots of money into his race to try to keep it and keep him in the Senate. And Democrats are going to view that as one of their real potential pickups in the U.S. Senate.
Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. He talked to us about yesterday's primary election results. Coming up, does the federal civil service need an overhaul? We'll look at a past and potentially future effort to take away job protections for large numbers of federal employees and what it can mean for political appointments. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.